From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President George Bush tries to calm America's fears about the economy. Candidates Barack Obama and John McCain spar over the Iraq War. Our political contributors are here to parse things out. With us, Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Also with us, Robert Trainum. He's the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Hi, folks.
Hello, Farai.
So let's talk about money. With the president. He gave a press conference addressing the economic issues in this country, talked about the energy crisis, his plans or hopes for offshore drilling. He lifted an executive order on offshore drilling, asked Congress to lift a ban. But he also said the financial system was, quote, basically sound, that despite all the economic news like the government takeover of IndyMac and the rescue attempts on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So Bush said he's optimistic about the economy.
Despite the challenges we face, our economy has demonstrated remarkable resilience. While the unemployment rate has risen, it remains at 5.5%, which is still low by historical standards. And the economy continued to grow in the first quarter of this year. The growth is slower than we would have liked, but it was growth nonetheless.
Mary, to be quite honest, are people listening to the president at this point when their wallets are telling them something different?
They may be listening to him, but they don't believe him. And they're right not to. Whenever the president has to tell you that the economy is good and that he is optimistic and you should be optimistic, there's something wrong. It's like Nixon saying, I'm not a crook. So the fact that he has to tell us all that, and I actually don't think that anyone, the president, the Congress, in dealing with the Fannie Mae crisis and the rest of it, no one knows precisely what to do. Bernanke, they don't actually know exactly what to do, how to fit all these pieces together. We're in uncharted waters. We haven't been in for a long time in this country, and not before, because many of the mechanisms that are in place now weren't in place when we had the Great Depression. I mentioned that word in the 30s. So I think that people should hold on to their wallets, hold on to their hats, and see how we're going to come out of this. And so I don't think Mr. Bush giving us these reassuring words will do that much good.
Robert, let me jump in with a little bit more from Capitol Hill this time, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke.
The effects of the housing contraction and of the financial headwinds on spending and economic activity have been compounded by rapid increases in the prices of energy and other commodities, which have sapped household purchasing power even as they have boosted inflation. Against this backdrop, economic activity has advanced at a sluggish pace during the first half of this year, while inflation has remained elevated. The economy continues to face numerous difficulties, including ongoing strains in financial markets, declining house prices, a softening labor market, and rising prices of oil, food, and some other commodities.
Robert, you hear the words sluggish and all sorts of other indicators in his speech that say, well, yeah, things aren't going great. So first of all, what are we supposed to make out of all of these statements? And remind us again what the Federal Reserve Chair really has to do in these situations.
Well, you know, Farai, it's pretty interesting. There's really two audiences out there. There is the American people, which the president's trying to speak to, which he tried to do yesterday. And there's Wall Street, which is Bernanke's audience. And Bernanke basically said, look, we are moving at a very, quote unquote, sluggish pace. Notice he didn't say the word recession. Notice he didn't say the word depression. He certainly would never, ever say something like that unless we are technically in a recession or a depression. But the answer to your question specifically, Farai, this is a very complicated beast. If anyone knew how to fix the economic engine, so to speak, it would have been done already. The economy is so complex, the American economy, that is so complex, so cumbersome. As the president said, if he did have a magic wand or if someone had a magic wand, they would have fixed it already. So the real issue, and I go back to Mary's point here, is that the American people out there do not trust this president, unfortunately, because he has a credibility gap. But if you listen to what he's saying, unemployment rate is still relatively low. The economy is moving, albeit very slowly. The American people are just simply not buying it simply because of the previous transgressions of this administration.
Now, you've got all of this news, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, you know, bank collapse, run on a bank. I mean, that sounds... You were talking about the Great Depression, and so the economists have not even wanted to use the word recession. Do you think that there's a chance that we could go into a depression, Mary?
Well, there's always a chance, simply because nobody understands what's going on now. And because not only is the American economy complex, we're so tied in with the global economy in ways that that are more make even more complexity. My mother called me on the phone and said, did you see all those people lined up taking money out of the bank? Reminds me of the Depression. And she started trying to tell me to go take my money out of the bank if I had any in there. And I said, no, Mom, there's the FDIC and a Federal Deposit Insurance Card. I tried to explain, you know, reassure her about all these things. But in any case, I think that no one knows really what is going to happen. In the Great Depression, eventually, we worked our way, the world did, out of it, and then there was a war. Here, it's not as bad yet, and there are some things that we may be able to manage, but others we can't. We can't do much about the price of oil in the short run. We can't do much about food prices, which is a worldwide problem with shortages and people starving in some places and competition and lined up to get food and using food to make gas. I mean, all of these complications exist, and the people who don't want to lend money are worried about people not being able to pay it back. They may be able to do something about the housing crisis internally, if they can get the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac legislation together. And perhaps that will help in the short term. But I don't think anyone has an ability to see beyond this, and anything could happen.
You know, Farai, very quickly, right after the Depression in 1930s, the American government stepped in, the presidency as well as the Congress, and said, never again. We have to put safeguards in place. For example, the FDIC, which insures individuals' money out there from $100,000 or below, the Federal Trade Commission and so forth, so to make sure that we do not have another depression. Remember, back in the 1930s, depression unemployment rate was at 25%. Mm-hmm. There were millions, and let me underscore that, millions of people that were out of work and millions more that were in breadlines. So we are nowhere near a depression. Let me just underscore that. However, this economy is moving at a sluggish pace.
Well, let's, Farai, I've got to make one other quick point. Deregulation, which we've all forgotten, in the 80s and the 90s, many of the measures that were put in place after the Depression were repealed. The prohibition on banks and how they could lend and what they could lend to, which is how they got into all these problems. All of that went out the window because we had a big reform movement in the Reagan years that we really didn't need all that regulation. And nobody needed to watch all these people. The free market would take care of it. And some of that now is coming home to hurt us.
Okay, we got to move on. We got a couple quick things to touch on. One of them is the war. Barack Obama outlined a new plan for Iraq and Afghanistan, but Senator John McCain is criticizing Obama for making this plan before he goes to Iraq, which he is planning on, and talks with military commanders there. Let's listen to a little of McCain's concerns.
Senator Obama is departing soon on a trip abroad that will include a fact-finding mission to Iraq and Afghanistan. And I note that he's speaking today about his plans for Iraq and Afghanistan before he's even left, before he has talked to General Petraeus, before he has seen the progress in Iraq, and before he has set foot in Afghanistan for the first time. In my experience, fact-finding missions usually work best the other way around. First, you assess the facts on the ground, then you present a new strategy.
Mary, on the Sunday morning talk shows, which us political geeks often watch, a lot of the senators, surrogates, and supporters were saying, well, he's not a flip-flopper on issues like, you know, religion. He just is informing himself with a changing time. So does Senator McCain have a point? Well, how can he make a statement before he's, you know, seen what's going on?
Well, McCain does have a good point. I thought that was a good comeback on the part of the McCain campaign. But I think the most interesting thing that happened on the Iraq question is the LA Times I read that Obama's website took down the language which said that the surge was not working, which had been there for months and months, has been there since the beginning, and took it down and put up some other mealy-mouthed language because the surge obviously did, quote, work, if you mean by work, that the violence is down, and if you don't think about all those refugees who fled and the people who got killed and so on. So that McCain seems to have been right about that. Also, it might have been better for Obama to wait until he went, but he had already made a misstep when early on, a week before, he made it sound like he was changing his mind and his supporters jumped all over him. So he was now trying to make a preemptive strike by saying what he plans to do before he goes. But in logical terms, it doesn't make that much sense.
Robert, I got to move on to one last thing for you. In other political news, the senator And that's John McCain spoke at the NAACP convention today. Senator Obama spoke previously. Let's take a listen to Senator McCain.
Black and Latino students are among the most likely to drop out of high school. I don't have to tell you that. African Americans are also among the least likely to go on to college. After decades of hearing the same big promises from the public education establishment and seeing the same poor results, it is surely time to shake off old ways and to demand new reforms.
He reportedly got a standing ovation at the end of his speech. Robert, do you think that the education issue is the right one to use to lever African-American support?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Interesting enough, Farai, very quickly, John McCain got a very warm response from the NAACP today in Cincinnati. That's number one. But also number two, speaking on the issue of education, that is a major wedge issue within the African-American community, because there are some out there in the community that absolutely want school choice. There are others that do not for various reasons. And so what John McCain is trying to do is say, see, I am one of you. I want to be your education proponent. I want to be the one in the White House that's going to push for pieces of legislation that's going to give you, the parent, the opportunity to make a decision that's best for you and your child. Again, he got a standing ovation for that simply because he understands that one of the major issues in the Black community is education.
Just a smidge from you, Mary. Right issue, wrong issue. Smidge.
It's the right issue, and McCain has done himself a lot of good by showing up and by making that speech. And there's a lot of buzz in the community that, hey, maybe this guy McCain is worth taking a second look.
Okay. On that note, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Farai.
Thank you.
Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And Robert Trainum is the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Both spoke to us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It ranged from fiery outrage to middle-of-the-road ambivalence. We are talking about your overwhelming reaction to the New Yorker magazine cover depicting Barack and Michelle Obama. We received 10 times the usual response to our post about that controversy, and here to tell us about it is Jeffrey Bennett. He's the web producer for News and Notes. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well, Farai. How are you?
So, for those who haven't seen it, the July 21st issue of The New Yorker shows a cartoon depiction of Barack Obama wearing a turban, robe, and sandals. Michelle has got an afro, combat boots, a gun, an American black flag burns in the fireplace, and that's just for starters.
Right.
Both of the Obama and McCain campaigns have called it offensive. So summarize the reaction on the blog.
Well, most of the 130-plus people who've commented on our blog already say the magazine missed the mark. People like Jasmine Santee wrote, "I understand the satirical intent, but the execution is extremely poor. And when you get a bad cartoon that skates on the edge of offensive, you give up on satire." And there's this from Terry, who wrote, "Someone finally had the courage to paint a true picture of what we can expect from Obama." Apparently, he's not an Obama supporter. And this from Paul Brook, "People should get over it. Laughing in the face of fear is our best weapon against ignorance. And laughing at our own fear is really a lot more effective than laughing at the opposition's." So here's what Obama had to say about the New York cover, the New Yorker cover last night on CNN's Larry King Live.
"Well, I know it was the New Yorker's attempt at satire. I don't think they were entirely successful with it, but you know what? It's a cartoon, Larry. I do think that, in attempting to satirize something, they probably fueled some misconceptions about me instead. But, that was their editorial judgment. And as I said, it's a cartoon. It's not where the American people are spending a lot of their time thinking about it."
Also, last week's big story on our blog was the faux pas by Jesse Jackson, who was caught dissing Barack Obama on a microphone that Jackson thought was turned off. What's the latest news online there?
Well, if you remember when Fox News aired the clip, Bill O'Reilly said there was more that wasn't aired that was, quote, more damaging than what was heard. So yesterday, several left-leaning blogs picked up that East Coast radio host James Entume reported that Jackson had called Obama the N-word and called him a half-breed, among other things. But late yesterday, the blog TV News reported that Fox News shot down that rumor and said that Jackson said no such thing and that they weren't going to air any more of the tape anytime soon. Anytime soon, I guess, being the operative phrase. So who knows when and where this rest of the tape could turn up.
All right. Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. What is blogging while brown, and does sounding black mean less money in your paycheck? We'll do an interesting little on-air experiment. We've got that and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable. With us, freelance journalist Danielle Belton. She runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. LN Rock, otherwise known as the African American Political Pundit. He's also a member of the Afrosphere Bloggers Group and author and DJ Richard Graves. He writes the blog DJ Black Adam. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, Fry.
Hello.
So this weekend, hundreds of bloggers of color are going to gather in Atlanta, Georgia, for the first ever Blogging While Brown Conference. There's no way to know how many will show up or how many are out there. 6 months ago, the blog search engine Technorati was tracking more than 112 million blogs worldwide. Well, worldwide minus China, which keeps its own statistics, about 70 plus million more blogs. So, LN, blogging plays a big part in your life. You're a member of Afrosphere, a group of African-American bloggers. Tell me more about Afrosphere and some other ways you're working to bring black bloggers online.
Yeah, we have been working for about a year now, pulling black bloggers together to address many of the issues that are going on in the African-American diaspora around issues of color, arousal, bigotry, racism, conflicts within community, and really community building, changing the way people look at African-Americans as well. So we've come together as black bloggers and have said, hey, listen, we're tired of other people addressing our concerns and seeing us in a different way. We need to get out there and communicate it the way we feel is necessary. And that's what we do as African-American bloggers.
Now, you guys, what about this conference? Anyone going?
No, not me.
No, I'm not able to. I'm working on a project up here, so I'm not able to go down there. But I would like to. I think it's a good thing for everyone to get together down there, the African-American bloggers, to talk and exchange ideas and physically meet each other. A lot of us talk to each other online and maybe through email or phone calls. But I think it's a good thing for everyone to get together and talk about the issues of the African-American community, especially with this election going on, and, you know, and just maybe make some connections and work towards getting information out and doing different things with the blogosphere that we have.
Are you disappointed that you won't be able to go?
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed.
Yeah, I am too, personally. I mean, I've met a lot of people. I've been emailing people. I've networked with a lot of people through the internet. And so I was just kind of curious to see, you know, who these people were, to put kind of like faces to these blogs. So on my part, yes, I am kind of disappointed that I'm not able to go.
You know, bloggers are not exactly known as herd animals. I mean, the people who are tend to be people who are brought together by more commercial blogs like Gawker and, you know, and sometimes nonprofit blogs. But it's also one of those things. One of the things that it's made it really popular, I believe, is that people can do it on their own. Do you think that there should be some kind of more organized, Richard, association of black bloggers? Is there one I don't know about?
No, if there is, I don't know about it either. But I think it would be it would be good if we had some type of central, not authority per se, but a central group of bloggers that we could, I guess, coordinate with when we are talking about specific issues or if we're trying to get action on a certain thing, maybe a crime that happened that's not getting enough attention, or maybe something in politics that we want to try to forward. It would be good to have a central group of people from different ideologies that we could, say, okay, look, this happened and we want to shine the light on this, and how should we do it, or how should we petition and kind of, you know, organize things in that way. I think it would be a good thing if we had something like that.
I feel like Afrosphere has been able to do that on some level. I mean, I'm also a member of the Afrosphere, and there's been a lot of issues that have been brought to my attention that, you know, don't pop up in television and in print that I've learned about online through other black bloggers. So I feel like Afrosphere is trying to do something like that.
Yeah, I think they are.
And I will concur that the Afrosphere has been doing a lot. I know with Jenna Six and the sister that was down there in Texas, and right now we're gearing up for another effort, which probably both of you all know about, but I'm not going to announce here, but you'll hear about it in the next couple of days. The Afrosphere.
Oh, come on. Come on. Now, if most people have heard about it, tell our audience.
Well, the Black Bloggers, there's a Black Bloggers organization called, if I'm not mistaken, Black Afrosphere Bloggers Association. And then there is the Afrosphere Bloggers Group, which is a group of Black bloggers. I guess we're numbering about 140 now, and we continue to grow. We're a political bloggers group to some degree, but as at the same time, a social activist bloggers group. And we come together as a think tank, essentially. And one of the things that we're taking a look at is the issue of, and I should be ashamed of myself, but I'm going to do it, the issue of tasering, the tasing of many African-Americans across America. And it's an issue that is really important, and current public policy is not good with regards to police and what they're doing in African-American communities. So it's something that the Afrosphere will be addressing shortly.
So it sounds like your mandate goes well outside of, okay, well, what's up with technology? It goes into social issues.
Oh, yeah, big-time social issues. You know, with the Gen 6, we were actively involved rousing the people out there that do actually read bloggers. And the good thing about blogging as well is the fact that Google has now used bloggers in a different way, too. They actually allow for anyone that Googles an issue, it goes to the blog as well.
All right, I'm going to ask you guys an incredibly impolite question. They say, you know, at dinner parties never ask about religion or money. So this is a money question. Are any of you guys making money off of your blogs?
Define money.
The thing you spend to get food?
I think I might be able to buy some food with the money I make off my blog, although milk's gotten pretty expensive, so that might be out of my price range of what I'm able to pull down from the Black Snob.
Gentlemen?
Yeah, I haven't tried to, actually. So, you know, I have a few links to, like, a couple of products that I have, but nothing major. So, no, I haven't really tried to.
I'll tell you, I like Francis L. Holland, who is one of the Black bloggers out there. We have probably about 10 or 12 blogs on our own. So with AdSense and other activities, I don't make a living through blogging, but I do get significant dollars, not just from AdSense, but from other activities that I put on my blogs for advertising.
Do you think that there needs to be a general upgrade in how people approach whether it's Black bloggers or other bloggers, particularly with a social or educational mission, and how people approach the revenue side, which is constantly in flux? Ellen, do you find that bloggers really, and I'm not talking about the big commercial blogs, but smaller bloggers know how to monetize their product, to use one of those awful internet words?
Yeah, I don't think Black bloggers actually monetize to the level that they should. There's a couple of people out there that are attempting to teach Black bloggers how to monetize, like the other bloggers that are actually getting political dollars, as an example. There's a lot of political advertising out there. It's interesting that the Black blogs, as I've noticed, aren't even getting the political ads from the Democratic Party.
All right, I want to move on to a bit of fun, of course, a mix of seriousness. There's a question posed on the economics blog, Freakonomics, based on the best-selling book. How much does it cost you in wages if you, quote, sound Black? New research by the University of Chicago compared the wages of people who sound Black when they talk to those who do not, and they found Blacks who sound Black earn salaries that are 10% lower than Black folks who do not sound Black. Now, for what it's worth, whites who sound Black earn 6% lower than other whites. So We did a pretty fun little thing where we got two of our NPR West employees to give us a clip. And what I want you to do, and I'll just use the order, LN, Richard, and then Danielle. LN, Richard, and then Danielle. Listen to this voice. There'll be two of them. Listen to the voice, and as soon as it's done, tell me black, white, or other. Okay, you ready, LN?
I am.
Okay, let's listen to the first voice.
Jack and Jill ran up a hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after.
Ellen?
Black.
Richard?
Black.
Danielle?
Black.
Okay, let's listen to another voice.
Jack and Jill ran up a hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after.
Ellen?
White.
Richard?
White.
Danielle?
I want to say white, but that could also be other.
Okay. Well, you guys were generally right, Danielle. It was not other but white. and, you know, we missed our chance for the really subversive one because one of our employees is both black and British, and so we were hoping for a curveball, but she's also on vacation. Do you believe that do you believe it, Ellen, that there's this great significant disparity in earnings?
Oh, I have no question about it. Coming from Boston, and my diction is a little bit different from others, I've had the same question posed to me, where am I from when I speak? I get opportunities that are different because of my speaking.
What do you mean? What kind of opportunities?
Well, diction, and as well as when I go for an interview for a position, as an example, they say that I talk differently. So in talking differently, I have gotten opportunities that I don't think I would have gotten otherwise.
Richard, do you think, have you ever had a moment where someone either criticized, you know, like, oh, you sound too white, or you sound too this or that or the other?
Yeah, I've heard that before. You know, being in Chicago, sometimes in speaking with people, you know, they'll say, well, you sound white, which I find utterly ridiculous. But I do see that, you know, looking at the fact that there are white people when they supposedly talk black, and I would assume that we're talking about the dialect, the African-American vernacular English is what we're talking about, I'd assume, or Ebonics. You know, I think that it's just like with the Southern dialect, they also get paid less, too. I think that Midwestern English is a standard that is expected in professional settings. And I would think that if you are interviewing in that sort of setting, that you might want to, you know, watch a few TV shows and try to make sure that your grammar is up to par and that you're talking the standard English of the nation. You know, I mean, the sub vernaculars, I think, are inappropriate for business settings, things of that nature. So, I mean, it's just something that we have to adapt for.
All right, guys, we're going to have to wrap it up right here. Danielle, sorry you didn't get a chance to comment on this, but
it's okay.
If you want to send us something for the blog, we're always up for that. Thanks, guys.
No problem.
Thank you.
We've been talking with author and DJ Richard Graves. He writes the blog DJ Black Adam and was at member station WBEZ in Chicago. LN Rock, otherwise known as the African American political pundit. He was at our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Danielle Belton runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. She was at member station KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. He was the star of this year's Super Bowl, and today the New York Giants' David Tyree is here with us to talk about the catch of his life. Now I'm going to pass the ball to our very own Tony Cox.
Thanks, Farai. I'm going to try not to drop it because the catch by David Tyree will forever be engraved in the minds of football fans. You might remember that catch back in February during the most watched Super Bowl in history. Against tight defense late in the fourth quarter, Tyree grabbed Eli Manning's pass, wedging it impossibly between his right hand and his helmet. It was something to see, and set up the New York Giants for their upset win over the Patriots. He'll have a book out in September called More Than Just a Catch, chronicling his path to unlikely Super Bowl heroism. David is in town for the ESPY Awards. He's nominated for, what else, Best Play. David, welcome to News and Notes.
Man, truly excited just to be here hanging out with you guys.
You know, David, you have something we don't get to see very often here in Southern California, not since the Raiders left town. That's a Super Bowl ring. Where is it?
Yeah, we got to hang this nice piece of jewelry up here. It's man, I tell you what, you work hard, blood, sweat, and tears all year round just to hopefully wear one of these. Took Michael Strahan 15, took me 5, so I'm doing all right.
That thing's heavy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pretty heavy, but this kind of weight you don't mind getting right here.
Listen, we talked about the fact that the book, More Than Just a Catch, is coming out. Now, that's really quick. I mean, the Super Bowl was in February, and here we are in the summer, and the book's coming out in September. So you must have, tell me, started working on this before.
Well, you know, I think the book is something that would have, maybe possibly been in the, down the road, what happened, the Super Bowl never happened. But when you look at the series of events and what God has kind of done in my life, it's no greater, timing, and timing is everything. So it's a lot to give in my story. You know, I've been through some tremendous struggles, and it wasn't until I came into this wonderful relationship with Christ, and I wanted to, share that with the rest of the world.
Now, you talked about your history, and it has been checkered, would be a fair word to use.
Yeah, certainly.
Let's talk about some of the things, because I know before that you had your epiphany, you had some run-ins with the law.
Yeah.
I read this about you, and I'm like, am I reading this correct? That you were fined by the team,
yeah.
And in order to raise the money to pay the fine, you sold some weed out of the trunk of your car.
Well, not really out the trunk of my car, but I was selling weed at that point. That was where that's how dilapidated my mind was. You know, what your mindset, just how progressively things can be and can progress. But it was I was dealing with the same struggles a lot of people deal with the substance abuse, alcohol, marijuana, obviously being an NFL lifestyle, women, and whatever else is at your grip. And when I got the fines, basically my mindset was, hey man, I got some good bud, I got some good marijuana, I might as well start selling it. And, it's amazing how gripped you can become, and people like to think that, the music or, the things that are, out there in our society don't have impact on people, but they do. My thing was, hey, it was a keep it real generation. And that's as real as it gets. You know, you want to be a gangster, let's stop playing. And,
is that what happens to so many young athletes, particularly black ones, who keep getting in trouble with the law, even though they have all this money in their pockets?
Well, you realize that I found that this is my personal experience. If you don't have the right understanding, the wisdom and the know-how to understand what the money is used for, I believe it intensifies every dark part of your life. Whereas, I liked women, obviously, now I attract more women. I got drugs. Now I can afford the drugs that whereas I couldn't afford them before. So that's exactly what money did for me. And that's when you say the love of money is the root of all evil. When you don't have the right understanding of the means of it, it goes usually to the wrong places.
Tell me about the epiphany that you had.
Yep. Obviously, those are my struggles. And I get to that point where I'm selling these drugs with friends as well. I get pulled over with a half a pound of marijuana, and while I'm in that jail cell, first time in my life where I sincerely cried out to God. I wasn't raised in a Christian home at all. Didn't even do church on Easter. All the drug dealers in church on Easter, But, I'm in that jail cell, and I just said, God, all I know is I need you right now. And if you don't mind, I would appreciate it if I can keep my job as well. And that's, like I said, I was a real prayer. And within that time span for about 11 days, God, kind of literally delivered me with no lasting effects from alcohol, drugs, never slept with another woman other than my wife. And 11 days later, I walk into a church where, I probably wept in the back of the church for about 20 minutes as I saw this woman singing to God. I saw that she had peace. I saw she had joy as she sang to God. And I realized that, there's 80% of men my age would trade places with me in a heartbeat, but I didn't have that. And so I wept and I gave it all to God, gave it to Christ, and my life's never been the same.
A lot of people are talking about black fathers these days because of Barack Obama's Father's Day speech, and there's been a lot of controversy. You're a father. You grew up without a father, as I understand it.
No, I actually had a very good father. He was just divorced. My parents were divorced. He was very close. Always around, but that still has a lasting effect, which kind of raises a certain level of bitterness that that I thanks to my relationship with Christ, I learned to be free from. There's different levels. So many people grow up fatherless, or in so many, especially obviously in black homes, or in minority homes, they grow up in single parent homes. And, you know, it raises a level of a mindset of destruction where it was never intended to be that way. And, you know, so a man doesn't, there's only certain things that a mother can do for you. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain things that you need, you know, that you need from your father, you know, or even if you, especially as a male, but even as a female, a father, you know, his job is to show, you know, his daughter what she can expect.
Now, you're a father now. You've got twins this year.
Yes, I just had identical twin girls.
Congratulations
on
that.
And so my job is, you know, is twofold, you know. You know, obviously to show my men, you know, what it is, you know, show my boys what it is to, you know, foster them and be obviously number one God-fearing, but, you know, love, respect, you know, all those virtues that we need to, you know, raise our children in, but to show my, you know, show my daughters as well what they need to expect, you know, from a man, you know, so that they're not slighted, you know, as they grow up.
Let's end this with talking about football. If you had dropped that ball, would you still have a book, and what would the name of this book be?
Oh, man. If I dropped it, I would like to think I still have a story that's definitely worth telling. You know, who knows when or when God would open that door, I don't know. The name of it might be, you know, just simply Brokenhearted.
That's it. You know, your number 85 jersey is up there. You know, you only have 4 catches all of last year. One of them, one of the greatest catches, and maybe you'll win the ESPY. We hope you do. It was a great catch. Put us in that moment. We've got about a little less than a minute. Put us in the moment. Here's the ball coming.
Yeah, the ball's coming. Obviously, the circumstances, you know, maybe a minute left, less than a minute. Eli, you know, that's the first half of the miracle is him getting away from 3 Patriot defenders. Ball's in the air. You know, you just do your best to position yourself. High point it, go up. I feel the heat from Rodney Harrison, my Siamese twin, for a little bit. And, you know, I didn't know anything. I'd be lying if I told you I knew I had that thing on my helmet. But the only thing in my heart, I'm just saying I ain't letting this ball go at all.
Man, it was a great catch, and it was something I'm sure you will remember for the rest of your career. Rodney Harrison said you will never make that catch again in 10,000 tries.
Yeah, you know, I hope his heart was right. I'll be the first one to agree, but I hope his heart was right when he was saying it because, you know, I'm not taking credit for the catch. I'm giving it all to God. You know, and that's the biggest difference. And, you know, I think he was a part, you know, he was just an instrument as well. I think he did everything in his natural ability
to make
that play.
David Tyree, great having you. Thank you very much.
I had a great time. Thanks for having me.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with David Tyree. Tyree plays for the New York Giants and has a forthcoming book called More Than Just the Catch, which will be on shelves in September. He joined us here in our studios at NPR West in Culver City. To check out video of our interview with David Tyree, go to nprnewsandviews.org.
And then I said something I felt regret for the crew. I find no comfort in it, find no joy in it, so I immediately called the senator's campaign to send my statement of apology if any harm or hurt that this may have or may cause his campaign.
Apologies. They're bountiful in America these days. Jesse Jackson recently apologized for remarks he made about Barack Obama. Barack Obama apologized for the way his staff handled 2 Muslim women at a recent political rally. And we reported yesterday that the American Medical Association recently apologized for years of discrimination against black physicians. But when is apology appropriate? And could apologizing ever work against you? Our regular contributor, Judge Lynn Toler, has heard her share of apologies in her time on the bench. She's here with us now. Welcome, Judge.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. So
good.
You have done so many things in the courts. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But I want to find out if you consider yourself a good gauge of the sincerity of apologies. Let's start with Reverend Jackson's statements. I don't want to repeat them here, his apology afterward, which we heard. What did he need to do to give a successful apology, and did he do it?
I think he did give a successful apology. I I am of the camp that though he said it, it wasn't really, he has the right to his opinion. He thought he was talking down to black people. He said something tacky and rude, no doubt about it. It was inappropriate, but he didn't think he was being broadcasted. And, yeah, I'm sorry you heard that, but guys who are out there in the world, especially through the age and the time that he was out there, sometimes their language isn't all flowery and beautiful. And he didn't think he was being heard by America. It was the off-the-cuff, you know, comment he made because he was irritated. So I think his apology was more than adequate.
Let's go deeper into your life as a former municipal court judge. Has an apology to you on the bench ever changed your mind?
Yes, it has changed. Well, it sometimes changes the nature of the conversation that I have. Everybody apologizes to me when I'm on the bench because I'm the person that determines whether they go to jail for 60 days or 18 months. So I'm sorry. That is, you know, their attorney tells them to do that. But if I get an I'm sorry followed by an indication that he or she understands the nature of their wrong, why it happened, and I am able to engage them in conversation about how to change what they do so it will not reoccur, an apology plus will get you somewhere.
What constitutes a good plus? Give me a very concrete example.
A very concrete example of a good plus. If you have a situation where, I had a situation where this guy had shoved his wife. And he said, you know, I am so sorry that I did that. And, you know, my daughter was in the room. And he says, it hurts my heart to think she saw me do that, that I didn't. You know, that apology was one that included an understanding of the depth of the wrong. He didn't say, I'm sorry, but I was upset. He said, I'm sorry, and I see how wrong it was.
I want to move on to another case, and not your case. Stan Tookie Williams was sentenced to death by lethal injection. Before he was executed, he apologized for founding the street gang, the Crips. He never apologized for the murders he was convicted of and maintained his innocence of those crimes, even when perhaps it would have gotten him lenience. Are there advantages, and we don't know whether or not he was innocent of those crimes, but are there advantages to apologizing, even if you've been convicted?
There might be advantages to your soul. I think by the time they got you strapped to the table, they don't care what you say. You're going to go.
But what about previously for something like parole or life imprisonment as opposed to the death penalty?
That would have to take place at the time that you were... In the parole proceedings, it does make a difference because you do have to accept responsibility. A lot of parole boards don't even want to hear you unless that jump has been made. And the right apology, but it has to be an apology plus. I'm sorry alone, to me, is rather meaningless. I'm sorry. A lot of times it's, I'm sorry I got caught. I'm sorry there was a problem. You know what I mean? I'm sorry that I'm here. But I'm sorry doesn't mean anything if it doesn't follow by, you know, true contrition and change. And that's what the parole board's looking for. That's what a judge is looking for, the true contrition and change.
Let's talk about a different aspect of the legal system, an apology. One example is that there was an inmate named Daryl Hunt who served 18 years for murder. He was proven innocent and exonerated in 2004. Later, the city of Winston-Salem in North Carolina offered a financial settlement and an apology to Hunt. Is that kind of apology good for everyone?
Absolutely. No doubt about it. That kind of apology is good. Number one, because it was followed by an act of contrition, which was monetary, number one. And number two, it is good for people to see that the system can acknowledge that it made an error. That gives better confidence in the system. Some judges don't think that, but I really do. Once it's clear you messed up, to say mea culpa means that we've looked at what we've done. We do not believe we are right just because we are the final word. And that allows for growth. It allows for better systems. It allows for, you know, judges to rethink what they do, to be more willing to reopen cases. So that kind of apology, I think, does benefit public faith in a system that they're required to rely on.
Very quickly, what can we learn from how the justice system treats apology?
We can learn that apology alone is meaningless unless it is combined with other things. An apology, however, is often very meaningful in and of itself on an emotional level. Victims' families need to hear that. It doesn't change. It doesn't make closure. But they do have some feelings that need to be addressed. An apology in that form, when you're acknowledging another person's, your damage to another person's emotions, life, that does have meaning.
Well, Judge Toler, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of Divorce Court and author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. She joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. And that is our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we continue our month-long series on jazz. We'll take a look at the best places around the country to hear artists perform.